So the question then becomes, how do you make yourself valuable in the future? How do you make sure that you continue to be smart?
That is the voice of futurist and number one best-selling author Mike Walsh, and he'll be our guest on today's Super You podcast.
It's one small step for man.
Liftoff. We have a
liftoff. We choose to go to the moon, not because they are easy, but because they
are
hard.
I have a dream.
You can't handle the truth.
7.
6.
5.
4.
3.
2.
1.
Super, 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 super.
Super you. Well, I'm super excited for today's guest, Mike Walsh, who we randomly ran into last night at the airport, which is crazy because he is all over the world. He travels 300 days a year, but it is Mike Walsh. He's a global futurist who, as the CEO of his company Tomorrow, helps business leaders and Fortune 500 companies thrive in this era of disruptive technology change. And Mike has given over 1,000 speeches over the last 10 years. So I couldn't be more excited, and we'll dig into it. And there's a lot that we're going to go over, but it's great to have you here, Mike. Welcome.
It's great to be on your show, Eric. It's good to see you. I think if it wasn't serendipity, it would have taken us forever to get together. So I'm glad.
And it's perfect timing because you have a new book out, Algorithmic Leader. And tell me about that. What is an algorithmic leader?
Oh, where do I start? I mean, maybe the subtitle will help people. The book's subtitle is How to Be Smart When Machines Are Smarter Than You. And what I really want to do is write a hopeful, optimistic, and practical book for leaders of all kinds to know what to do next in this time when people are saying that robots are coming for our jobs, that automation is going to destroy industries, and, well, that we should lock up our children because the superintelligences are coming.
And then I've listened to you a lot, obviously, and I've seen you out there, and you mentioned that, hey, don't really talk about millennials per se, but look at the next generation, Gen Z. And why is that? Why do you stress that to a lot of audiences?
I tell that to people because we often talk about millennials like they're the future. But the reality is that millennials are the present. I mean, they've won the present. They own the present. They've got everyone worrying about them now. But by 2030, they're going to be as old and as miserable as the rest of us. So we should really think about who's going to inherit that world of 2030. And for me, it's the kids of today. It's the 8-year-olds. I mean, these are the terrifying people. And any of you that have young kids, and I know you do, it's amazing when you actually just look at the way they use technology, the way they make decisions, the way they communicate and consume content. They are as different to the millennials as the millennials are to us.
Yeah, with my kids, it's interesting. If I say, hey, give me a minute, all of a sudden they say, Alexa, set timer for a minute. So I've learned that trick.
That is, I've never heard of anyone say it. That's cruel and unusual.
And then there's always, obviously, whenever I don't know the answer, well, Google it, Daddy, just Google it. So definitely growing up in a different world, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's an interesting example because, I mean, that's your kids demonstrating essentially cybernetic augmentation. I mean, they've delegated their memory to Google and they've delegated their voice to Alexa.
That's well said. And so I look at you and I go, if you could see Mike, go Google him, but go out there and Google him just like my kids would say. He looks like a futurist. He's got the voice, but most importantly, he understands where we're moving to, what the future looks like. Before we get into that, which we certainly are going to do that, I didn't read in your bio some very interesting things. So Mike is a global nomad. So that means he is traveling the world 300 days a year. He has homes in London, Sydney, and also in Hong Kong. Now, a lot of our listeners out there are digital nomads or want to become global nomads. So is there any tips or advice on how you can do that?
Be sure that you want to, because I think traveling continuously is not always as glamorous as it might seem and requires a lot of logistics and good running shoes. In that you need to be in constant motion and you need to understand the way airports work, the way tax systems work. You have to understand your own health. It's incredibly complex, but if you can pull it off, it's incredibly rewarding because you lose that sense of permanency. You don't feel that the world is made up of discrete countries and cities because you literally wake up in one city and you fall asleep in another. You're in constant motion.
Have you ever woken up and not know where you are?
All the time.
Yeah, all the time.
Yeah, all the time. But fortunately, one of the superpowers you have to develop is the ability to sleep anywhere and under any circumstances. So I'm lucky I don't get jet lag. I can pretty much instantly adjust. It'll probably catch up to me one day. I'll just wake up one day and look like Yoda. I think most Chinese people do at some point. So being half Chinese, I will inherit that. But I think the most important thing and most challenging thing about being a global nomad is actually your social network. When you're not part of anywhere, people stop including you in their plans. So you actually have to be very proactive about developing a network around the world, so you've got people to see and to keep tabs on you, and that, you know, you keep the journey interesting as opposed to just, you know, sitting in drab hotels and raiding the minibar and watching Netflix.
And so you've developed a global community, which again is easier said than done, because I'm sure sometimes you're jet lagged, you're arriving, you go, do I want to set up a dinner the night before I have to be on stage and perform in front of 5,000 people? But it sounds like you pick your spots where you go, you have to maintain that sense of community.
And like you, doing a podcast is a big part of that, because it forces you to go out there and meet new people, to learn stories. And the most important part of my job, I find, as a futurist, is actually not collecting information on trends or science or technologies. It's actually talking to people and hearing their stories and their experiences. And so that is the most valuable thing I do, is really collect and curate stories from different places in the world.
And you've mentioned this before, I believe, is that you look at the future and everyone has this mindset that it's scientists, it's technology. But in fact, you say it's more anthropology.
Absolutely. I mean, when you ask people to think about the future, they tend to think of gadgets. And they'll have a view about whether to buy the iPhone this year, or it's worth upgrading to the new PlayStation or the Xbox, or what life might be like when they have 5G speeds rather than 4G. These are all actually relatively unimportant shifts to the world. They don't lead to necessarily massive transformations. The future really arrives in all those small decisions that we make as human beings, and the second and third order unintended consequences of those decisions. They shape societies, they shape our organizations, they shape us as leaders. They're very human, they're very analog. And you discover those things in, you know, a street market in Brazil or in India or in Mexico City, or the places where you would least expect to find the future.
And Instagram would kill me if I didn't ask this question. So here I am I'm at the cocktail party tonight. Listeners, you're at the cocktail party tonight. They want to go to that cocktail party and say one or two things, like, here's what's coming in the future that's exciting. So tricky question for you, but go for it. What are some of the things that get people excited when you mention this is going to happen?
Well, the biggest difference, I would say, if you look at the world of 2030 versus the one of today, most of the physical stuff will remain the same. I mean, yeah, there'll be some self-driving cars and your Domino's pizza might arrive by drone. But the most interesting factor would be almost every service you use, whether it's in retail or finance or transportation, will be all driven by AI and algorithms whose sole purpose is to study you continuously, to look for ways to delight you without you even asking. So retailers will start sending you products even without you ordering them. You'll be contacted and bank loans will be organized for you, you know, even just as you start to look for a house before even asking. So the whole world will essentially start to orchestrate offers and services and promotions all for you individually without you doing anything. And it's kind of hard to visualize now, but really the future will be service driven.
No, it makes sense. And as you look at it down the line, so I want to just get into this a little bit. You've been fortunate to sit down with Jack Ma, with Reed Hastings. When you sit down with these leaders, I'll call them digital leaders, is there any common traits or tips that our listeners can learn from these folks? Is there something you start to see that common thread amongst them? That's what we're trying to do here on the Super You podcast, is give out those common threads.
Yeah, one of the things I wrote about my book is that it's starting to become clear that there is a divide between one set of leaders and another. let's call them analog leaders and algorithmic leaders. And it isn't generational. A lot of algorithmic leaders who are very successful, and you mentioned Reed Hastings, Jack Ma, Jeff Bezos, Satya Nadella, CEO of Microsoft, they're not necessarily young. They've actually at some point had to make the conscious decision to do things in a new way, to upgrade their own mental software. And it's profound and it's powerful. But it isn't about learning programming or just learning some new buzzwords to throw into conversation. It's about shifting your mentality. And you can play around with this. I mean, you think about some of the biggest corporations today. I mean, there was a time when we used to revere leadership heroes like Jack Welch or Steve Ballmer. But can you imagine if Jack Welch was now running Amazon rather than Jeff Bezos? Or you had Steve Ballmer running Microsoft rather than Satya Nadella? Or you had, I don't know, Rupert Murdoch running Netflix instead of Reed Hastings? It wasn't that these were bad leaders. It's just that the kind of skills and capabilities and approach to solving problems to be effective in a time of data and artificial intelligence are remarkably different.
And then when you look at the book, so obviously you've got tons on your plate, lots going on. So this is really core and passionate for you. What was the driver behind writing the book?
I think writing a book personally is really about crystallizing things that you've been thinking and talking about for years. And the great thing, as you know, of being a speaker is that you get to prototype your ideas to a live audience. And it's like being a stand-up comedian. You know, I used to keep a diary when I was speaking. So I would note down, yeah, this bit worked, that bit didn't. They had no idea what I was talking about when I said this. And I don't do that so much anymore, but you do sort of subconsciously pay attention to the way you phrase ideas and the way you frame them in what order. So at some point, that reaches a critical mass in your mind, and almost just to purge the cache, you've got to put it down in a book and bring it together. So the algorithmic leader for me was the culmination of really my thinking of the last 5 years.
And when you write, because there's a lot of writers out there, a lot of people have a book, everyone has a book in them. It doesn't mean they need to write it. They might hire someone to help them write it. But where do you
go? Nor does it mean everyone's going to read it.
Yeah, exactly. But when you write, is there certain places that you write? Do you always write on the plane? Do you always write in the hotel room? Are there certain times? Like, how do you get the book done? Because that's hard to do.
I cannot express the sheer inertia of doing work on a plane. I wish I would unlock so much productivity. Just the pull of just watching some mindless entertainment on my tablet is so high that it is in the plane. What I do is every year, I take a couple of months off. I don't get on a plane. I usually go back to Australia. I've got a place in Sydney, in Bondi Beach. And that's sort of my happy place where I exercise, I eat well, I don't fly, and I work on ideas.
Is it the same time every year?
Yeah. So January, February, sort of December to February, I pretty much say no to any jobs. It's when I just decompress, when I read lots of books, I think up new concepts, and I really outline my next books.
Wow, that's great. And then we dig into this. This seems like a very benign question, but a lot of people have a difficult time. They're not flying 300 days out of the year, or traveling 300 days out of the year. So they want tips and tricks on that. Are there certain ways that you've learned to sleep on the plane? Do you use certain pillows? Is there certain exercises you do? Do you stretch on the plane? Do you use any Ambien? You know, what can you help the audience with?
Why is it I've got this terrifying feeling that that's actually just a list of everything that you do? I want to see your special pillow. Is it green?
Nah, I wish.
Is it infused with Ambien?
That'd be good. It's a new invention on Amazon. Go get it.
Ambien pillows. That sounds terrifying. Actually, no, it isn't much. I don't drink on planes. I don't drink much at all, actually. I mean, basically my regime is that, I don't really like plane food, so I'll try and eat well before I fly. I focus on sleeping on a plane. My view is, with jet lag, is that sleep is a bank. You know, you need to make regular deposits. It doesn't matter when they happen, as long as that within a 28-hour frame that there is some 8-hour deposit you've made at some point. And if I wake up at 3 a.m. in a hotel room, that's the start of my day. I'm not fussed about it.
No, it's good. I'm glad you brought up the drinking, because a lot of people have the misnomer that I need a glass of wine, it'll help me sleep. It actually does the exact opposite of that. It might help you fall asleep faster, but it's not restful sleep. So that's also something that I've learned, is that I won't speak the night before. I won't drink the night before I speak, which can be an issue down in South America, because they want me to go out with them. But I go, hey, I can either be great tonight or I can be great in the morning, but I can't be both. What do you want? As we look at your book, Algorithmic Leader, people out there want to know, are we going to still have jobs? Are robots going to take over the world, or are we going to still have jobs?
If you think about where we've come as a civilization, there's always new technologies. There are new tools, and it changes the way we do things. And there's a period of adjustment, and then people evolve, adapt, and move on. Even in the last computer revolution, it wasn't that computers took jobs away from people. People with computers took jobs away from people who refused or were unable to use them. And what tends to happen, whether it's the introduction of automation in manufacturing or the Industrial Revolution or the ATM, is that new technology will come in. It changes the value that human beings create, which means we need to redraw the lines of what a job is. And I think we're in that moment now. I don't think AI will destroy work, but it will mean that certain types of work really shouldn't be done by people anymore. And that's routine, transactional, easily definable work. And whether you talk to a bank or an insurance company, the leaders of those companies will tell you today they're making massive investments in robotic process automation. So very simple, routine tasks will be done by machines. So the question then becomes, how do you make yourself valuable in the future? How do you make sure that you continue to be smart?
And you talk about computational learning. So everyone with kids out there today, it's what should we be teaching our kids in school? Because I was just talking with the top superintendents in the United States. I was just at a meeting with them, and they said, look, everything we're teaching right now is going to be obsolete. So we're trying to teach them a different way to learn. Talk a little bit about computational learning, what it is, and what does that mean?
So, the example you gave about your kids is a perfect example of this. Why do you need to teach kids to remember facts when their memory is Google? Why do you need to teach kids, how to do arithmetic or remembering things when, they can get Alexa to set a timer? So what you actually need to teach kids is how to approach a problem, how to separate its strategy from its execution. So how do you break it down into small pieces and then look at it again in a creative way and go, okay, now I need to develop a strategy for solving this. I can use technology as part of that. I can use computation for the heavy lifting. And that's if you scale that up, that's exactly what those kids will be doing when they join a company and they're working in logistics or marketing. It's how do you creatively break a problem down, use first principles to kind of analyze it, and then think of a smart way to tackle it. Actually, a good way of teaching kids that is Minecraft. Minecraft teaches kids a lot of the basics of logic and how to approach problem solving. But when we get older, we need to be even more advanced. One of the differences between a traditional leader and a new generation one is the difference between someone who is deterministic and probabilistic. We teach people to be deterministic. Like, if something happens, do this. If you kind of want to do a marketing strategy, you should copy these companies who did this. But in the probabilistic world, it's different. In probability, you can be 70% right. And I think people struggle with that, because if you think about our time on the savannah, if a tiger is chasing you, you can't be probabilistic about it. It's like, that tiger's not going to eat me at 70% chance. It's just, you just run. Teenage girls understand this, though. They don't have friends. They have frenemies. So they can understand that their girlfriend is 70% their friend and 30% not. So we have to teach leaders to see the world in the same way, that as new information arrives, they can update their mental model. But it's very different than just seeing the world as black and white.
I like that. Frenemies, there's co-optition. Obviously in Silicon Valley, the co-optition between, there's a partnership on one side with Google and Amazon, and all of a sudden they're complete enemies on its other side.
It's an ecosystem.
Business.
And as you bring more AI into the organization, the AI doesn't tell you black and white something. It tells you something with a confidence margin. So people need to be able to understand, okay, the AI has given me this recommendation. It's a 90%. Should I trust it? Where did the data come from? Who gathered the data? Is the data biased? What's the anthropology of the data? And then they can form a view about whether to believe it or not. And that's where people will add value, is adding context and empathy to automation.
And then how do I, as an individual, kind of, so to speak, upgrade my own software? How do I make sure that I'm relevant? What's it look like in the future for me as an individual?
You know, at a high level, this is the way you've got to look at it. In the future, your value is not going to come from making decisions. It's going to come from you designing a system to make the decisions. So you need to get really good at understanding statistics, probability, creativity, nonlinear thinking, out-of-the-box thinking. You need to be able to do things that machines can't do. If it's just basic pattern recognition or remembering facts, you're toast. But what if you think about it, where you really will add value is being able to work between the cracks between these systems and to design work rather than do it. I'll give you an example. This is a story I came across. There's this kid called Josh Browder, and he came across to America from England, and he was here to study. He got all these parking fines, and he didn't want to pay them. So he wrote some code to automate challenging all the fines. And he got off them and thought, this is great. I mean, other kids could use this. So he released an app called Do Not Pay. And this thing's amazing. I mean, literally hundreds of thousands of parking fines have been now overturned from this automated system. But if you think about it, you know, what Josh did is exactly what we should all do at work, which is refuse to work, but look for ways to automate the activity that we're doing.
Not good. That's a good story. I love it. And then speaking of good stories, we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about how we first met.
Yeah.
So as I'm sitting across from a modern day James Bond, and so this will all...
Where is he?
In context, is that we're in South Africa, and we're with one of the richest men in the world. He had his conference. He owns Cartier, Mont Blanc. He's the Richemont Group, so all these big luxury brands.
This does sound like the setup to a Bond film.
Yeah. And we're in a tent...
Surrounded by wild animals.
Surrounded by wild animals. We're in Kruger National Park because they own part of the park. So we're physically in the park. So as we sit in the tent, you can see silhouettes of giraffes and lions on the outside walking by. But the coolest thing was Tony Hawk, the skateboarder, was also there. And we're just sitting in the tent going, where are we?
And why are we here?
Yeah, why are we here? So it's been a long journey. So it's good to have you here face to face.
And if you think about it, that was about 8 years ago, I think. Mm-hmm. And it was a very different world. I mean, when we talked about digital then, it was really about social media. It was the beginning of the social media boom. But we've come so far in 8 years.
We have come so far. I remember the big argument was that no one is going to buy a luxury good online. And so we were there to push the envelope. We were the pioneers getting that pushback. So it was fun to kind of see it just in such a short time.
Yeah.
Now it's evident to everybody that you're going to buy anything and everything online.
You know, the only thing that you can buy in China is fakes.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah. And now China's the biggest luxury market in the world.
No, it's crazy. And obviously you spend a lot of time in Hong Kong. So we're going to get into, I want to unwrap that.
Okay.
Because we've talked a lot about the future. And I want to talk about individuals' futures that are listening. So they see you. A lot of the listeners out there want to learn from you. And some even want to become you. They want to become the next you. They want to become the number one best-selling author. They want to be a futurist. They want to be speaking on stage, traveling the world. When we dig into that, first of all, it's very interesting in your bio, because I was reading that your dad was the CEO of Harrods. And for those that don't know Harrods, it's probably the most recognized, what would you call it?
Just department store.
Department store. Most recognized department store in the world, headquartered out of London. But when I saw that, it's interesting because obviously you have a lot of great stories. You have a Gary Vee, you have Tony Robbins. When you look at it, they came from so little. But when I look at it, it's not sometimes the most glamorous story, but it's actually more unique in my mind, is kids that don't necessarily have to do anything succeed. Like, you have to actually overcome just as much as they do when you think about that. So I just want to know, what did that look like? Like, growing up, how did you make sure that you were able to become what you are today?
The whole world conspires to keep us ordinary. Parental pressures, the system. I mean, the minute you go to school, you get pushed into a profession. And professions, whether it's being an accountant or a lawyer or a doctor, they're definable. It's about maintaining the status quo. So actually, it's the hardest thing is to pull away from the gravity well of the mundane. Because you can be very affluent, you can be upper middle class, but you're just following the same pattern as everyone else. And so probably the hardest thing for me growing up was that, you know, there's a lot of expectations that, you know, I do well at school, and then I actually enrolled to be a lawyer. So I studied accounting and law. I spent 6 years at law school. I didn't know what to do with my life. And I asked around and said, what's the hardest job to get? And a girlfriend of mine was like, she goes, well, everyone wants a job at McKinsey. So I said, okay, I'll try and do that. It wasn't that I wanted to be a management consultant, it's just I heard it was hard. So I went and interviewed a whole bunch of ex-consultants at McKinsey. I kind of tried to understand what their frame of mind was, and then I really just studied to be that person. So I went through all the interviews, I knew exactly how to play a management consultant. And so I got the job offer, but I still was, you know, unsure what to do with this. And then the internet happened. So this is the late 90s, and I was in New York, and I went to see someone that I had met at a conference who ran a big internet company. And I said, listen, I just would like some personal advice. I mean, I was 22. I said, look, I don't know what to do with my life. I've studied law. I've been offered a job at McKinsey. But, you know, I really love what's happening with the internet. Yeah. And he says, what do you think? He goes, come see me in the morning. So I came the next day and he had a contract on his desk. And he said, listen, forget being a management consultant. You can always do that. Why don't you start up our business in Australia? And I was like, but I don't know anything. I'm going to mess up. He goes, don't worry about it. He goes, Australia is so far away that if you mess up, no one will notice. <That's good. laughs> So that's how I started. It was a company which became Jupiter Research.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And they ran the Internet World Conferences. So as it turns out, if I had messed up, everyone would have known. But I ended up hiring a bunch of other kids like me, a couple of 18-year-olds, who were very smart. I had to hire them as journalists because I wasn't allowed to hire anybody else. Because the way I figured is, the only people who know about what's going on in the digital revolution in those early days in the late 90s were actually tech people. I said, you know, I can teach you how to write, but no one can teach you to understand this new world. So those were interesting kids. One of them's name was Mike Cannon Brooks, who went on to start a company called Atlassian, and is now one of the richest people in Australia, if not the world. I think he's worth about $7.5 billion dollars. And the other kid was called Nikki Skivak, who now runs the biggest venture capital fund in Australia.
And how old were they when you hired them?
18.
18. And you still stay in touch?
Yeah, of course.
No, that's great.
So it was an amazing time in the early 2000s. It was the first internet boom. We were sort of a bunch of kids who really didn't know what we were doing. But it was, as you'd remember, it was an amazing time at the birth of the digital world.
And then you look at your story, what were some of the darkest days in there, for lack of a better, you're a very positive person, but our listeners got to understand that it's not always roses on the road. So what were some of the man, what am I doing type of moments?
Well, I did this, you know, I did this business for a while, and then on my 27th birthday, I got fired. I mean, there was the whole dot-com crash, and companies were scaling back, and I just had no idea what to do.
Because now, you were fired or laid off?
Well, let's say laid off, but okay. To my mind, I was fired. Yeah. I mean, let's face it. And I wasn't used to this idea, because I'd stepped off the well-beaten path of becoming a consultant or an accountant or a lawyer, and I was unemployable because I'd spent my whole 20s just doing what I liked. So I couldn't imagine going and get a real job. So I had this kind of chaotic period of about, I don't know, 3 to 6 months, where I just did stuff to keep the lights on. I worked as a, you know, I did PR because I figured PR was one of those jobs that was so easy anyone could do. I couldn't understand what they did, but right. It seemed that they were getting money to do stuff. So I did that for a while. And I worked as a fashion photographer for a while.
Okay.
I just did whatever I could, you know, leveraging my hobbies. And then I had the fortune of meeting one of the Murdochs in a bar. Lachlan Murdoch, who we had a really interesting chat about the future of digital media, and he offered me a job.
And this is in Australia, because the Murdochs are from Sydney?
Yeah. So I ended up working for a news corporation for a number of years. And that took me to Asia. So I spent quite a bit of time touring around their Chinese, Indian, Asian operations, looking at what they were doing with digital. And it was an amazing experience. And at the end of that, this was about 2006, 2007, I really had a powerful vision of what I thought was going to happen next in digital. And so I wrote a book. I quit, I wrote a book, I went all in. As you say, I burnt the boats. And I just said, if I'm going to do this, I've got to stop working, because working is probably the worst antidote to leading an interesting life. And that book was called Futuretainment, which was published by Fiden. But it came out, it's almost the 10-year anniversary now. And it was interesting because someone posted on Twitter the other day something which was really encouraging. It just said it was about Microsoft's announcement for Stadia, like real-time gaming delivered to any device. And all this guy wrote was, Mike Walsh was right. And there was a picture of my book, Futuretainment. Because that's what the book was about. In 2007, I wrote, there's a world coming in which every piece of content, every game, any kind of experience will be delivered on a server that you don't know where somewhere to a screen that you own. And that'll be the end of it. That'll be the end of release windows, of formats. It'll just be content on a server delivered to you.
And that book helped launch what you do now, which
absolutely
is fantastic. And what's been your most, it's a tough question, it's a real tough question, but one of your more unique experiences when you think about where you're speaking or whom you're speaking with or what the audience was?
No, that's a tough one. I've been to some very unusual places in the world, from Rwanda to Saudi Arabia and to Mexico. And sometimes when you're there, the way they find you is always an unusual story. You must have experienced the same thing. I met my current wife on a job that I did in Turkey. She was in the audience when I was speaking in Istanbul. And I was only there because the organizer, who was Greek, was a fan of my photography, my hobby, that he'd found me on Flickr. And he just wanted to hang out with me. So when you think about the nexus of events that leads to something, it's often, you can't plan it in advance. I was giving a talk in Saudi Arabia once in Riyadh, and it was this big conference. This is before all that, Khashoggi affair, of course. But I remember I just got a call in the middle of the night saying, and I thought it was a prank call, saying, we want you to come to Saudi Arabia to speak at this conference. I didn't think it was real. And of course it was real. And when I was there, I was at this breakfast, and it was like a Masters of the Universe breakfast. There was the global CEO of Dow Chemical. There was the global CEO of McKinsey. There was members of the Saudi royal family. And then there was me. And I remember thinking, how am I here? Because it turns out that a member of the Saudi royal family had found me on YouTube. And he'd said to someone, this guy, bring him now.
That's good. Some good SEO right there. All right, Mike, you're always looking at the future. To take the opposite of that, what's your oldest personal memory? And how old were you?
Palm trees. I must have been 3 or 4. I actually grew up in the South Pacific, in Fiji, on a tropical island. My dad was working as an expat in a local department store there. And apparently I spoke Fijian before I spoke English. My wife tells me I speak in a strange language when I sleep, and I was hoping it was alien, but it could well be Fijian.
And then obviously traveling the world, there's no typical day for you, but fill in the blank here. A great day is when ...
When I'm not traveling. I mean, to me, an amazing day is get up, have a great breakfast, go do some exercise. When I'm in Australia, I train this place called Icebergs. And if you can imagine, it's this pool that's actually built into the side of a cliff overlooking the ocean, filled with seawater. And it's just magical to train down there. And then, I'll see friends for lunch. I'll do a bit of riding in the afternoon and then go out for dinner. That's a perfect day.
It's funny how you mentioned that, you're not traveling, because everyone out there goes, I want to travel. And then you love traveling, but at some point, it's always that balance. And I think that's interesting from a standpoint of similar, I'm in the same way.
I like your 52-night rule. That's a good one.
Yeah, no, for the listeners out there, you know this because I go over it all the time, is we have a 52-night rule. I've got young kids at home, so early on I realized, wait, I want to be with my kids. And so once we hit 52 nights away with my head on a pillow away from the kids, then we stopped taking any kind of deals and also partnerships for me to perform on stage. But what that's allowed us to do is we actually take the kids often with us. And that's been a gift, just to have them come with us to Singapore, which I know you spend quite a bit of time there, Vietnam, Colombia. So they've been able to travel the world with us.
It's a huge gift for kids. And I think probably the biggest influence on my childhood was the fact that my parents traveled a lot. And my dad traveled a lot for work, and they took us with them. And I think from a very early age, that gave me a sense of the global bug, the sense of different perspectives, of being open and curious. But, you know, to this point of sometimes restricting even your economic growth, I think it's important because we're at this really interesting moment where we're having to reconsider what wealth is, or the asset trap, or capital accumulation. You know, there is extraordinary inequality in the world. But a lot of that is just driven from the fact that for most of us, and we're included, the only way to make more money is just to sacrifice more hours or to do more things that you aren't prepared to do. And really, the hallmark of people that are truly wealthy isn't the amount of assets they have. It's experiences and freedom. And, you know, even when you're successful and you've achieved the things you want, just because you can do something doesn't mean you should. Mm-hmm. And there's this sort of incredible moment of maturity where you have to realize, how do you want to design the kind of life that you actually want to lead, not the expectations that other people put on you.
I like that, life design, and also just the constant reminder to all of us that time, all of us have the same amount of it. So that's the most important asset. If you look at the show like Breaking Bad, there's that scene where there's just a pallet of money. And the wife asks, how much is enough? When is it going to be enough?
And Rosebud.
Yeah. There you go, Rosebud. I like that. I like that. And so along those lines, a bad day is when ...
A bad day when you basically have no control of your destiny, you know, whether it's delayed flights or canceled contracts or obligations have been put on you for no apparent reason. It's when you're just a slave to outside forces and you have no agency whatsoever. It's very hard to feel happy on those kinds of days. And you know, to the earlier point you said about the things that drive and why we do things. Time is limited. And I think, you know, one of the biggest fulfillments that I get personally is not just when I'm passing through time, but when I'm capturing my thoughts, creating things, and leaving something, you know, crystallized of value. I think that's the highest fulfillment that we can get.
And then, like you mentioned, control what you can control, because there's a lot of stuff outside of your control. So just focus on what you can control, and everything else is just, hey, that's going to happen, and just got to deal with it. Now, as you look at this, is there a book, a movie, a poem for our listeners out there that has really influenced you, or maybe it's something you give to people, but if there's a book, a movie, or a poem that absolutely all the listeners out there, they should check out?
Basically, I read a lot and I listen to a lot of music all the time, but I just can't pick between that stuff.
No, fair enough. Is there any ask that you have for the audience, or how can we find out more about you?
I would really love to connect with the audience, so please follow me on Twitter, on Instagram. It's both, my hashtag on both is Mike Walsh, so I'm easy to find. I've got a brand new book out, as you all know. Please go and buy it on Amazon. It's also available on Audible. I went and did the task of locking myself in a studio in London for 3 days and read the thing myself, which turns out it was harder than I thought. But that means you can listen to my dulcet tones for 6 hours, which I'm sure is a wonderful incentive.
Yeah, well, it's a great voice. I mean, I may have you read my books. That'd be wonderful. All right, Mike, so you're outside the elevator. The elevator door's open, and it's the CEO of Walmart. As you step in, he recognizes you right away because you're very recognizable. He knows what you talk about. He knows you're a thought leader on the future of leadership. And he goes, Mike, I only have 5 minutes before my next meeting. Can you tell me what the future of leadership looks like, and what am I not doing? What is it most likely that I'm not doing?
Whether it's the CEO of Walmart or any big CEO of any major organization, the temptation in the next few years is just to automate everything. Whatever you can automate, automate it. Whether it's in accounts receivable or something in logistics or service or those ridiculous things that you have to use as customers to self-check yourself out in supermarkets, everything. But the real challenge, I think, is when you automate, how do you elevate the people in the organization as well? Because if you miss that step, that's when you throw away real productivity, real creativity. There's a really interesting story about when Elon Musk built his first factory. Because he didn't build it, he actually bought it from Toyota. Toyota had built this very sophisticated car manufacturing site. And they had put quite a lot of automation in, but not everywhere. And they did that for a reason, because the Japanese believe in Kanban, and they believe in people on the production line, you know, looking for areas to improve. What did Musk do? He put automation in everywhere. And then after a while, he realized he'd made a terrible mistake, because the moment you lock everything down with automation, you lose agility, you lose imagination, you lose creativity. So people is a big part of the equation in the future. So if I was talking to the CEO of Walmart, I would say, what is your plan for migrating the people in your organization when you bring in technology? What's your vision for where people will be adding the most value? How do you redesign your human resources to really leverage human potential?
No, I love that. I love the analogy of the grocery store checkout line. No one likes those express checkouts because they never work properly and they always have to have a person there to help you. And it's always slower than going to. But obviously, we're big fans of technology if it's used the right way. But a lot of times we see it, whether it's a phone tree, you know, press one, press two, automated. They can't understand you. But it's that viewpoint of view that makes sense. It's that combination of the two to get it right. That's it for today's Super You podcast with the one and only Mike Walsh. Once again, that's W-A-L-S-H. And also check out algorithmicleader.com. But anyways, just want to give a huge thanks to Mike. He's a great person and a good friend. And most importantly, he's a fantastic thought leader. So go check out his stuff. You will not be disappointed.
7.
6.
5.
4. 3.
2.
1.
Super, 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 super,
super you.